Hello, everyone, and welcome to Book Spider, a Book of the Week format podcast known for our anti-Charles Dickens hot takes and our mild, melancholy pessimism about the future of everything we hold dear.
Fuck Charles Dickens.
Today, we... Yeah, that's right. Bleak House, what an overrated piece of shit. You know what he needed? An editor. I'm not really even joking. It's been very interesting to me, actually. I know this is not the subject of the podcast, but like... You know, the three of us read Bleak House, and the whole time I was reading Bleak House, I was thinking, man, this is like a bloated, inefficient, frequently risible, not without virtues, but certainly, like, it's hard to imagine this is really, like, not a classic in any sense, even compared to a lot of other 19th century stuff. And I just keep, since we recorded that podcast, I just keep encountering examples of how much people fucking love Bleak House. You know, like I randomly bought a book of essays on literature. Technically, I think lectures on literature by Nabokov. And there's an essay in Bleak House. And it starts with him just basically acting as though, you know, reading Bleak House is like picking up a giant, luscious donut and taking a giant bite. And it's just, he adores it.
Oh,
the gulf between like the entirety of how all of like the Western literary tradition receives Bleak House and how the three of us did still continues to baffle me. I don't know. But none of this is relevant to the subject of this podcast other than perhaps, you know, me being a hater. But we're talking today not about Bleak House, much as many of our audience would love to hear more of our thoughts on that. But today we're talking about Yesteryear by Caro Claire Burke, which is a recent successful debut novel that became an object in the discourse, capital D, and is now on its way to a filmic adaptation produced by and starring Anne Hathaway. And, you know, I think it's reasonable that this particular book isn't quite the sort of thing that I or my co-hosts Patrick Barney.
That's me.
And Chris Malmberg.
Me.
Would read for fun. And that's that, Chris, that the whole point of that is so that folks can recognize your voice when you speak. So you are now going to have to use that voice for the whole rest of the episode.
I'd really rather prefer to talk about Bleak House than Yesteryear. Bleak House, as much as I hated it, is much, 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 much better. I can't do that anymore.
No, you can't.
Right.
It's too irritating.
So Yesteryear, you know, it's not quite the sort of thing that I would read for fun or that I think that Patrick Barney and Chris Malmberg would read for fun, but it has achieved roughly the thing that all of us would have considered to be the dream when we were 25, in that it's gained widespread attention and financial success while also being, from what I could tell, taken seriously and seriously considered as a statement about its cultural moment. So I thought it would be illuminating, perhaps, to, you know, give this book a shot, right? The essay I read that brought it to my attention put it in the same league as something like Gone Girl, right? That is terrifically entertaining, but, you know, also tries to achieve a certain greater level of depth and kind of like say something with capital S's. And so I thought, well, you know, let's see what the state is of cracking pot boilers that also make a statement in 2026, right? What is the state of the art of socially meaningful, elevated entertainments? So Yesteryear tells the story of Natalie Heller Mills, who is a woman with a successful media career that could pretty much be shorthanded as tradwife influencer. The book opens and we see Natalie carefully stage managing the presentation of an authentic family life with the off-screen assistance of nannies and a producer. And then we follow two timelines that advance in parallel, one of which shows her dropping out of college, meeting her husband, who is the son of a successful senator and likely presidential candidate, and then the other timeline finding her mysteriously trapped in and seeking to escape a literal version of the 19th century frontier life that her work as an influencer is seeking to glorify. When I wrote this, I said that since this is a pretty new novel and one whose pleasures for some readers may be plot-driven, I'm actually not going to spell out the whole plot here. I actually don't know if there's too much plot to spell out outside of what I said, but, you know, I'm not going to go through the whole details of it right now. But do be aware, if you happen to be reading this and have not yet read Yesteryear and plan to, which I don't know if we'd recommend, but if you plan to, you know, we're not going to be shy about spoilers if it's appropriate to do so, even though I don't really think it's necessary to recap the whole plot to be able to kind of talk through the questions that I had about the book.
And it does have a twist ending. So if you're worried,
it does have a twist ending.
Like, and if you're worried about spoiling it, we might.
We're definitely going to talk about that.
Yeah, we're going to have to talk about that.
I will say that I don't find the twist ending that satisfactory. And perhaps Chris and Patrick, maybe you would vehemently disagree with me here. If you are listening to this and you haven't read Yesteryear, I'd say just listen to this episode and don't go read it. But
no, I agree.
Yeah. I will say, at about the 70% mark in reading this book, I began developing the theory, which I really, really hoped was true, that Natalie's father-in-law, who is running for who is a presidential candidate in sort of like a Trump-esque mode, although sort of like half Trump and half like a very socially conservative family values candidate. Like, basically, if you took... If Trump and Mike Pence were, if you had a halfway point between them, right? Her father-in-law, who's running like that, I developed the theory that he was literally the Antichrist and that Natalie is in hell, which did not turn out to be true, which is too bad because I actually think that would have ruled. So, I guess just to start with here, Patrick, you wrote a novel called Goosenau. That novel has an immediately dislikable protagonist who has very different values from the majority of its likely readership, right? And I think that's one way you could characterize this novel as well. So how do you feel like Goosenau is similar to or different from Yesteryear in terms of how it tackles the project of writing with a dislikable protagonist with contrary values?
It's similar enough that I feel like this whole podcast is an attack on me.
No.
No.
I was trying to think about ways to introduce this book that are different from how everybody else would, right? Because there are obvious entry points, right? Like, does this adequately, you know, does this dissect our cultural moment in a meaningful way? What is it trying to say about secular versus religious life? Is the twist ending disappointing? You know, those are reasonable questions to ask, right? But what's a unique entry point, right? And I think one is that you have personally written a novel that in certain ways is, I mean, I do think your novel is better, right? But you've written a novel that is, in some ways, trying to do a similar thing, and maybe even seems at times to have some of the same surrealism, although there's nothing literally surreal in this book.
I guess I definitely see the similarities. I was kind of thinking before reading this question, and as I was listening to the novel, I definitely thought, hey, this is kind of similar to what I did, in the sense that we're both writing novels about dislikable protagonists, and the novel itself is a satire of that protagonist. There are definitely aspects of Yesteryear that feel like flaws that I hope my novel doesn't commit. You know, for example, like I would say the main criticism I have of Yesteryear is that it's just too on the nose. It's just too obviously It's just too obvious a critique of tradwifing. Not that critiquing tradwifing is bad. I think that's fine. But I guess that maybe what I want to say is that it's like overly determined. Like there's not a lot of play in the novel. Like you don't get a lot of complex moments. You know, it's very clearly like trying to nail down like trad wife bad, which is my main criticism of the novel. And I guess I just hope that my book, you know, and my book is obviously trying to do similar things in that it's clearly, at least I think it's probably clear that I'm satirizing corporate culture and like, you know, the way corporate culture kind of uses people and objectifies them, you know, hence mixability turns people into worms, into objects who don't speak and have no motivations. I guess I wouldn't be able to say why, if like you said, my novel is better than Yesteryear. I'm not exactly sure why, other than I hope it's not as overly determined, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much about overly determined, right? For me, at least, right? Like, I totally understand what you mean about overly determined, but I think part of it is just that, like, you know, if you're going to have an unethical, dislikable protagonist or a protagonist who is contrary to the values of the readership you assume, have some fucking fun with it, right?
Yes,
you know,
sure.
I mean, like, it's interesting to me that, you know, when you were saying, Patrick, that you were worried that we were insulting your novel by comparing it to
right.
work, you could just as easily say, right, okay, immediately dislikable to protagonist, different values from the majority of the readership. In some sense, the protagonist is being satirized. You could apply that to, I don't know, Lolita, right?
Right.
Which is a wonderful book.
Right.
So it's, I mean, I just, there you go. I compared your book to Lolita.
Right, yeah, yeah. But Lolita is probably better than mine.
Well, Lolita is better than both Gusano and Yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm comfortable saying that. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, that's no slight on Gusano.
I mean, it's one of the greatest novels of all time. So what are you going to do?
And Nabokov is one of my favorite writers, like, full stop, right? So no shade on you to say that, right? But what I'm getting at here is more that, like, Lolita and your novel both, there's a zest that they take, I think, in adopting the perspective of this dislikable person in a way that they allow that person to have fun being a piece of shit, right? I mean, I know that the protagonist of Gusano is in some ways a miserable person, right? And his indulgence of his id has made him miserable, right? But there is, like, one understands the attraction of what he does, of thinking and living the way that he does. And one gets the sense that at some point it was genuinely gratifying and amusing to him, right? And it's interesting that, like, Natalie just takes so, it would just be a more fun, interesting book if she just enjoyed doing this, right? And it's
right.
interesting how far... It's interesting how much it goes out of its way to establish that she never wanted this, right? Mm. It's like, well, I'm not a trad wife influencer because I enjoy attention and it's fun to cosplay the frontier. I'm a trad wife influencer because I bought a farm to try to keep my husband happy. But oh gosh, like we were going to lose the farm. The only thing I can do is be a trad wife influencer. And oh, I just happened to succeed at it coincidentally, right? Like it's... unfortunate, I think, that she doesn't get to twirl her mustache a bit, you know? And there are many criticisms I might make of this book, but I think in terms of the ones that kept it from just being, like, more entertaining, I don't know, that decision seemed very paramount to me. Chris, you sounded like you wanted to contribute on that note.
Gusano is 1,000 times better than Yesteryear.
Well, thanks.
And and it is, I think, like, really down to the fact that, like, Gusano is having fun. And Yesteryear is really, I think, I'll say that, you know, Burke has found a lively voice for Natalie that is you know, one, I think, like, thing that probably makes – it's probably one of the mandatory checklist items that this book needs to have in order to be as successful as it as it's been.
And her voice is funny at times.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about saggy balls and calling people whores and things.
Yeah, yeah. It's lively. I think that,
right.
I think that the thing, so I've been thinking about, like, the most despicable main characters, protagonists in the books that we've read. So, Humbert, the dwarf, your guy in Gusino, there was another one that popped into my head that just left, but, you know, you don't have to soften a character's, like, evilness in order to make them more human. That's actually, like, a paradox, right? Or it seems like you should sort of introduce softness. And Natalie has a softness toward her children that occasionally sort of edges in, and also I'd say that, like, it does feel like Burke sort of pushes Natalie into a kind of a non sort of aware fugue state when she's acting like crazy sometimes, so that, you know, you don't get it's sort of like, as despicable as we want to see Natalie, as despicable as Natalie is, Burke really wants us to see her as pathetic. And I think that that's just less interesting, right? So, like, you don't have to be pathetic to garner sympathy while being a monster, right? Like, Tony Soprano.
I totally agree.
Tony
with
Soprano
that.
Is not fucking pathetic. Like, he's a monster. He's an absolute monster, but he also, there's something about him that is bewitching and charismatic. And Natalie seems like neutered on multiple axes, her character, to kind of just sort of serve a purpose. And that's key to me for why, you know, Gusino is 1,000 times better than Yesteryear. I really hated this book. I'm sorry to everyone. I'm just going to come out and say it. I fucking hated this book. And, you know, I'm happy to substantiate why. And fucking hating a book is not the same thing as, like, wishing that it didn't exist. I'll be clear on that. Like, I'm, you know, this book is serving some kind of purpose in the zeitgeist, right? And I think that that's okay. It's just that I couldn't give less of a shit about this book.
It is a little sad, you know, I mean, to the question of, like, whether hating something means it shouldn't exist. You know, things are zero sum ultimately, right? I remember talking about this with the Will There Ever Be Another You, right? Where it's like, I think it's to some extent legitimate to resent that book, A, for not really being a novel, and then B, for being such a half-assed novel as a novel, right? It's like, because there's only, you know, I use the example, like, there's the bookstore in Olympia, there's 8 books that get to be in the window. And if one of those is a half-assed memoir disguised as a novel, then, you know, like, something more deserving is being relegated to potentially the dustbin of history, right? Is being remaindered that might, you know, have the chance to succeed if that spot had not been occupied by something half-assed, right? And I feel the same way about Yesteryear, right? Because, again, like, you know, this was in the window at the bookstore, and you go in and there's 10 of them on a table right up front, right? And it's like, I'm not mad at it in a vacuum for existing, but it is legitimately, I feel like, kind of, maybe this is way too melodramatic to say, but it feels like kind of a lost opportunity for the culture that, like, all the oxygen this is taking couldn't go to something just better, right? Like, more interesting in some way, you know? And so to the extent that, I don't know that I hate it, but I think it's a little bit unfortunate that it has had the year that it's had for just that reason. You know, I don't have a smooth segue here, but just one of the few things, and I've not read a lot of critique about this book. I tried to go into it as fresh as I could, but I know that several people have criticized it for not taking seriously the inner lives of Christian women. Do you guys agree with that criticism?
I think I do. I think that it is a mark against it. I believe I remember when we talked about Gusineau, I appreciated Patrick's ability to make a character who is suffering because of his relationship to a system that he sort of explicitly celebrates and wants to be a part of, but like, I remember making the point that like, if you turn all CEOs into monsters, you neuter the argument against the system that makes their actions monstrous, right? So like a non-monstrous person in a system that perpetuates monstrousness doesn't need and can actually be a distraction if we are continuously portraying them as, you know, neglectful parents who are actively, you know, using their children for personal gain. And I have lots of friends who are pretty, you know, devout Christians. And I think that like the, I think that the interiority of Natalie is a big missed opportunity. And it's probably a big reason why I don't like this book, because there is, just a kind of an assumption that this makes some kind of sense, and not actually substantiating it is the lost opportunity. I think that I said one nice thing about Burke. I'll say another nice thing. Burke's great skill is in editing, turning this into a kind of a propulsive story is, I think, a result of the fact that she does such a good job of like cutting it into very like bite-sized pieces and dancing from one timeline to the other, and really following the tension of the you know drama that's unfolding, rather than the interiority of Natalie or any kind of digression that would illuminate something that I find more interesting. So I think that like, to some extent, the skill that she's exercising here that I do recognize is very effective, like very, very effective. This is the plot of this novel, like the summary that you read, Hans, somehow that is made into a page turning, a real page turner. And it does have that propulsive quality, I think, because of her editing and her sense of like a scene and like, moving very quickly. And, but that is antithetical to the type of exploration that I wish we had I think that there's an interesting silhouette cut here by the premise that, you know, is much more compelling. You mentioned There Will Never Be Another You. You know, Highsmith, Patricia Lockwood. I'm getting my Patricias mixed up. Lockwood.
You mixed up your Patricias.
Yeah. I'm mixed up my Patricias. Lockwood is, you know, the exact type of sort of digressive, interesting, like very, you know, more interested in following a thought than following the plot, and comes from a religious, you know, background and writes very explicitly about that religion. And that's the type of thing that I would want here, but it would be a very different book. So I guess that I agree. I think that you know, if you're trying to make a point about this lifestyle and then associate that with, you know, the kind of religious structures that are often associated with it, and then say something about that, I think that this book fails to do that by exploring what exactly is what is the real, like, interior connective tissue that holds someone to, like, that faith and this lifestyle. And I'm pretty deeply disappointed with this book for that.
I was just going to say it has like a straw man quality, where, you know, our main character, Natalie, she doesn't have a super complex psychology. And therefore, if if you're setting up this trad wife person as the object of scorn and the object of criticism, then she should better represent the thing you're criticizing. But since she's not super psychologically complex, like I said, she has a kind of straw man quality. Like you're critiquing something that is a simplistic version of the actual thing that you want to critique.
You could make it somewhat more effective in that way without turning it into Lockwood, right? Like, there are a couple of things that, if you just shifted a little bit, right? Like her courtship with and marriage to Caleb, right? Just the complete lack of any sense that we get of why these two people.
Their sex life, for instance, as just a kind of a real, like, look at this shitty, you know, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think that, like, it's, you know, it certainly is true that, or I believe it's true at least, that, like, you know, people who grow up religious because they kind of have to channel all their sexual and romantic impulses into, you know, one relationship that is like the relationship, that probably they, like, commit too quickly to people that they don't have fully understood or realized chemistry with, either sexually or romantically, right? Like, totally fair critique. But, I mean, I think you can portray that without making it as just completely empty of any, like, meaningful sense of specific character or personality as her relationship with Caleb is here. It's like they meet and they just go, yep. And then, like, we just don't really have much of any sense of, like, in either direction, why, you know? I mean, and I mean, I don't know, like, it just, I don't know exactly how I would write that, but it, many, many people, I think, could make it more compelling, could make you get a better sense of, like, oh, in that moment, I would feel that and do that, right? Same thing goes for, like, her rejection of the kind of world and values of all the people she knows at college. She just immediately meets them and goes, dumb alcoholic sluts. And then, right. And then just, there's no sense of, like, any ambivalence, ambiguity, consideration, any real, you know, it's not like there's no appeal to, like, drinking and hooking up with your friends at college. You know, there's a reason people do it beyond just habit and compulsion, right? And if she just had any attraction to it, if she considered it, it's like these things are just so, so deeply unconsidered. And it would be, you know, I mean, I understand that at some level, maybe, like, the point at the end of the book is that, in fact, she has been unkind, poorly considered, that, you know, all the people around her understand that she kind of isn't, in a way, right? That she's sort of an empty space where a person should be. But then, like, that doesn't really make her a very compelling character, you know? Even if that is the critique, it's not really a good critique. It's interesting, actually, I don't know that this is that relevant, but just, relative to stereotypes that people have. It was interesting to me to get to the end of the book and see in the author bio that she has an MFA, only because this is, like, you know, there's the idea you hear so much now that, like, if you want to write compelling fiction that sells, the worst thing you can do is go to an MFA program, right? That there's like a whole set of habits you'll get there that are completely contrary to like writing something that will be published and turned into an Anne Hathaway movie. And the MFA, the values of the MFA program seem to have not penetrated here. So, I don't know if this model actually totally fits now that I've read the book, but prior to having us all read Yesteryear, one of the things I also did was send everybody an article called Sanctimony Literature by the critic Becca Rothfeld. And that is an essay in which she cites the work of authors like Ben Lerner and Sally Rooney to bemoan a trend toward fiction that is excessively preoccupied with maybe as like its first aesthetic priority or its first artistic priority, demonstrating that its characters and by extension its author have the appropriate opinions about contemporary sociopolitical issues, right? At the expense of other forms of artistic daring or aesthetic merit. And I mean, Rothfeld, you know, that essay, there's a lot of things that she's tackling. To some extent, she's identifying the issue that she sees with contemporary fiction. To some extent, she's proposing opposing a set of aesthetic values. You know, to some extent, you can tell she's just kind of like habitually really dislikes kind of lefty internet spaces and is to some extent reacting to that. Of everything that she was talking about, I was probably the most compelled just by the critique of that trend in fiction, right? Because I do have similar experiences. I'll give you an example. This isn't a book any of us have, this isn't a book we read for the podcast, but the novel Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin, right? This is a novel about indie video game developers, and it begins with them making a game in, I believe, the mid-80s, if I remember right. And kind of the defining feature of the game that they make in the mid-80s is that the protagonist of the game is kind of rendered within the sort of limited rendered with the limited pixel palette, low-res palette, rendered as lacking either distinguishing male or female characteristics, and is referred to as them in the absence of, you know, being given a binary gender. And all of the, the game critics and the people who are trying to, like, push them into the normal frameworks all go, well, you can't do that. Your video game character has to commit. You can't call them them and make them genderless. They have to commit to a male or female gender. And, the heroic video game developers stand by their vision of a non-binary character in the mid-80s, right? And I think that you can, I think at least, and maybe the two of you will have different thoughts on this, but like, I think you can have fairly progressive contemporary politics and still kind of roll your eyes at that, right? And I'll admit that I rolled my eyes at that plot sequence, right? That idea, because it just felt so much like the only way that Zevin could think of to like make her characters heroic was to kind of retroactively transpose a contemporary culture war issue onto the 80s and then put them on the same side as, you know, the author and readers, right? Which is like, it just feels like a very blinkered way to approach fiction, you know? But anyway, so, you know, I think when I read the Rothfeld article, I think my experience with being annoyed by things like that was what made it resonate with me, right? Obviously, the world has bigger problems, you know, but this is what I care about, right? And I mean, fiction is what I care about. And I've really come to realize, I think, in the last couple years that I'm not that interested in of all the things that I can respond to about fiction, I think its precise alignment with my own ethics is maybe like at the bottom of the list, right? And something like that sequence in the Zevin or, you know, things like that. I just, of all the things to care about in making a work of fiction, like that just feels very, I care very little about it, and I think many contemporary writers and readers care a great deal about it. So, sorry to kind of ramble here, but the question, I think, was just like, do you have the sense that in that essay, Rothfeld was naming something real? And if so, is yesteryear an example of that?
I don't know if she's naming something real. Maybe because I don't pay attention to, like, up-and-coming, like, mainstream fiction that much. So I don't know if she's naming something real. I'll just say that I don't think that yesteryear fits exactly with the idea of sanctimony literature. Like, on the one hand, it is, like, its obviousness at critiquing, like, the trad wife ideal it is obvious. But I don't know if it ever gets anywhere sanctimonious, just because I feel like you have to be like legitimately sanctimonious, you kind of have to take a different tone. I'm not sure satire can even be sanctimonious. Like, you know, this isn't like Terry Goodkind, right? Like, this isn't, you know, a long, sincere screed about how, you know, lower right capitalism is great. You know, there it doesn't ever reach that level. Now, I suppose there is, like, maybe a lower, like, you could still be sanctimonious at a lower level, but I don't know. I don't know if it quite meets that definition to my mind.
I don't think it does, to be fair. Right. I agree that it doesn't.
Like, it doesn't quite get there. As far as the my response to the sanctimony literature article, I guess I would just say that all that matters is whether you're writing a good novel. And I would just say, you know, a good novel can be political. There are lots of, like, really good political novels that are not sanctimonious, that are not too obvious. And I guess I just think that, you know, it seems to be more a question of, like, writing a novel well as opposed to, having a certain type of content. So, I've read novels that, like, I obviously don't agree with the political opinions of the author, that I still thought were good, like Journey to the End of the Night by, what's his last name? Celine. Yeah. Like, that's an interesting, dark, dark, pessimistic novel that is also racist, you know? And, like, I think that there are ways to say that this is aesthetically good without, you know, endorsing the racism, right? Hell, I told you guys about this a while back. My black coworker was reading Gone with the Wind, and she's like, yeah, I think this book is great. It's just racist as hell, you know? So, I don't know. I don't know if Gone with the Wind is good, though. Like, I have no idea about that.
I wonder if more time, if it's easier to kind of make those judgments when you have a little bit of remove from whatever it is that's at stake, right? I mean, with, you know, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, maybe, like, I mean, I exist in a cultural ecosystem where I just hear an awful, awful, awful lot about they, them pronouns and non-binary gender identities, right? And it's like, I just don't want more, right? Regardless of how that theme is treated in fiction, whether I agree with it or not, to some extent, even whether it's well handled or not, I'm just sick of it, you know, like in the way that one becomes sick of a good song that one hears too many times, right? And I don't mean that as a reactionary statement. They're just some topics just get exhausting. Anything gets exhausting after a certain level of exposure, right? And it might be that, you know, I mean, I'm sure that like, well, like I love everything I've read by Orwell, and much of that is, you know, to a greater or lesser explicit sense political, right? But because I'm not, because I'm a tourist in the politics in question, it's just much less exhausting than something that is so scrupulously responding to and restating the well-worn politics of its moment.
I mean, that's fair. Absolutely. Like to, like, you know, I think it's totally acceptable and fine to not, to read a book just for the aesthetic.
And I think for the sake of kind of trying to come up with positive examples too, something like Checkout 19 by Claire Louise Bennett, which we read for the podcast. I love that book. And that book is, I think, very much about patriarchy. I read it a second time after we did the episode. And I suppose to some extent you maybe could even construct a reading which is essentially about a woman who has been like driven literally mad hatter insane by having to live with patriarchy, right? But I adore that book, I think partly because it has so many goals and interests beyond just making the statement patriarchy bad, right? And I think to some extent the fact that it has legitimate other aesthetic goals, and the fact that it is not making that point with a sledgehammer, except in the places where it is, right, it ends up being more powerful than if it were kind of written with that monodirectional impulse toward just making that point because that was like the primary purpose of the book and its readership, right? And, you know, I mean, something like, you know, there's a rape scene in that book that is like so... is ultimately, you know, saying something about what it means to live as a woman in a patriarchal system, and also is like so ambiguously written and so strange in how it's laid out and so contrary to how we think about a, you know, a classical rape scene,
right,
that you know, the three of us couldn't even talk about it without having to like cut out the part where we talked about it because we were so afraid of saying the wrong thing about it, right? And I find that
Mostly because we discovered I'm a terrible misogynist, right?
No, we didn't, though. We didn't.
right.
We didn't. It's not even that you had a misogynistic idea. It's that, like, we were so... We had no vocabulary to discuss that idea.
Right.
We had no vocabulary to discuss what that scene was trying to say without saying something that we were worried could be, like, taken out of context as a, like, 15-word snip and make us look awful, right? And I think that's ultimately, it's, you know, like novels aren't essays, right? Novels aren't a thing that you make a kid's, they're not a thing you make kids watch for 10 minutes at school so they know to, you know, tell a grown up if uncle tries to touch their pee-pee, right? Like it's not, I don't want them to be at least, right? Like it's the whole point of the novel is to make space for true subtlety, ambiguity, at least I think so, right? Like, you know, if I want to know that patriarchy is bad, I just think there are many better media by which to relay that message than a novel. I have come to believe, at least, right? And I think when I was 25, when I was in grad school, I'd have said, you know, because of the tools a novel has, because of the way that it can allow you to understand another person's subjectivity, novels are like the best way to show that patriarchy is bad, right? But I don't think that I think that anymore. And I think to tie it all back to, I guess, the ostensible point of this podcast, right? Like, I think Yesteryear is not at all making a case for the value of the novel as a way of being uniquely qualified to critique a thing, right? I have a couple other questions here, most of which I think, you know, there was a question about the idea of quality that I think maybe we've kind of covered. I don't know that we need to talk about directly,
but
right?
We'd get to talk about Terminator.
Did you want to talk about the,
no,
the Terminator?
No, it's all right. I just, you know.
Okay.
It's fine.
I just don't know that there's much. I think you could, you know, I don't think there's anything new to say about the novel based on that.
Other than, you know,
I do.
Terminator 1 and 2 are great. Everybody should watch them.
Right. Well, exactly. And I think it would be very hard for us to address that question without almost entirely talking about Terminator and only glancingly talking about Yesteryear.
Right, yeah.
Which is kind of, I mean, I think maybe this is like not ultimately an interesting object of consideration, right? Which is why we're in that mode that we get into sometimes where we're mainly talking about other things as a proxy for, you know, the fruit is lying there on the counter and it's just pulp and skin, right? So I do want to touch on the genre question though, right? Maybe like hypocritically, because I know I tend to kind of like roll my eyes and go when other people bring the genre question
at
up, right?
Me.
But like, in the past, I have tended to dismiss the question of literary versus genre fiction in relationship to like the hierarchies that we all were ingrained with in undergrad and grad school, but which I think are kind of were already being dismantled then and are probably pretty fully dismantled now, right? But I want to touch on that distinction to the extent that, you know, like I said earlier, I don't think this novel is like as embarrassing as like truly something truly bad, like The Watchers by Dean Koontz, which is like not just poorly conceived, but like profoundly poorly edited, right? I don't think it's like embarrassing in that regard, but I don't think it rises too far above adequately readable. I'm not even sure if Chris would grant it that, right? But like, I do think probably many, many other books are published that have more complex characters and more surprising plots and more compelling line level prose, right? Like, you know, it, like I said earlier, it's kind of a shame that we're not all talking about something else, right?
If Lolita is a 10, what is this?
If Lolita is a 10, well, what's a 1? Is a 1 like, is a 1 The Watchers, or is a 1 like something that you would read in an undergrad workshop about like Cro-Man?
No, like a 1 is The Watchers.
If 1 is The Watchers and Lolita is 10, I don't know, this is like a 3 maybe? Does that seem fair? I don't know. Do you guys agree with that number?
I feel like if it's adequately readable, it has to be a 5.
Well, maybe it's not even adequately readable, I guess. I mean, because the ending really is quite a disappointment, I thought. Maybe you guys disagree with me on that. And I mean, I guess maybe we, before we tackle the genre question, can we get, maybe it's worth just saying, like, was the ending disappointing? How did we feel about the rug pull at the end?
I think that I'm pretty disappointed by it because, which is no surprise. I think so. Twists. My sort of thought experiment with twists is always like, what happens if the reader is aware of this from the very beginning? You know, what does that change about the experience of the novel, and how does that shift the pressure on the writer to make that time worthwhile? And so in my mind, like, and the reveal is that she has not traveled back in time. She is just actually in a psychotic state. And, you know, some 20 years has passed. She is just continuing to live in this farm and, you know, is not, you know, not in her right mind. And so the reveal to me, it's so much more interesting if you, I'll jump to one side. Again, one book that I thought about when I was thinking back on Yesteryear was Rebecca. You have a woman in a setting that is confusing and things don't seem to add up. There's some sort of vague threat. And I love Rebecca. Rebecca is incredible. And there's a reveal in Rebecca, but there's also a level of awareness and participation I don't remember the main character's name in Rebecca, but the protagonist is not like so completely confused. Like Natalie is just actually pissing everyone around her off, her kids, like just do this, stop doing that. You know, like they're just very frustrated with her, and she is. In the end, it's kind of like the reveal seems to take away all sense of agency or like capability that she had to affect change, to do anything about her situation, because she was so fundamentally confused about her situation that, like, you know, it's a bit like, you know, kind of waking up from a dream. And that's, you know, there's a reason why that's sort of a poo-pooed in storytelling, because like it just takes everything that happened before and it makes it kind of, you know, not important, kind of meaningless. And it's not quite to that level, but, you know, I think, you know, if there was a, I think you mentioned it doesn't have to be Lockwood writing this novel. If Burke were to write this novel and say like, okay, the reveal, I'm taking the reveal away, and now I'm writing this as though, like, you know, she's not thinking that she's in the past, but she's confused about what time she's in her own life. And she's sort of bouncing around in her own head and like, and kind of unmoored. I like that the pressure that puts on the author a lot better for what would, you know, what comes out from that. And you know, I feel bad. I'm railing on this book. I just think that I see pretty clearly in my own head the things that I would do differently. And one of them is that reveal, because the reveal is a shocking thing that ultimately in retrospect robs Natalie of any, you know, what are you supposed to do on a reread through this? Like she's, so I'm anti twist ending. I think that it's poorly done. And I would, if you wanted to kind of explore the same sort of story, making it clear at the beginning that she's sort of bouncing around in time and not actually time traveling, but bouncing around in time in her head, I think that's just more interesting.
The ending doesn't help that, like, her psychological motivations throughout the novel are pretty mysterious, and you know, so I guess I wasn't, I found her like psychotic break unbelievable, I guess. And maybe if the novel had done the work to make this psychotic break seem more believable. I mean, I know there's like everything comes to a head. She like assaults her producer, you know, everything falls apart, but I don't know. I'm not sure.
I was just going to jump to your question about like literary and genre. I think that rather than thinking about them as labels that, you know, we recognize that they're not perfectly distinct. We've talked about that in the past. But rather about thinking about them as a taxonomy for categorizing books that have been written, maybe thinking about them as guiding reference points for like the choices that you make when writing the book in the first place. And this book, feels like it is genre. Maybe this may be a disservice to genre too, but like it feels like the choices are, you know, what is going to make the reader want to turn to the next page to see what's going on. And I think that that is more associated with genre than literary work. So maybe if Burke was thinking about this, you know, as like a literary exercise of like actually trying to explore spaces that, you know, she may not completely understand, or, you know, going in with not incomplete understanding and trying to listen to the characters and allow them to lead her to more interesting places. That feels like a literary compass versus a genre compass. And I think that it may be, I don't know that it's necessarily more useful to think about it on the writing side than on the marketing side. But I think that some more literary guiding lights in writing this book would have served it very well. I don't use that to denigrate like genre fiction necessarily, but it does feel like, you know, if you were to kind of like break it down to like a two-dimensional spectrum, genre is friendlier to that impulse to just kind of make your choices for what is going to be the most exciting versus the most uncertain and the most dangerous and vulnerable. And those choices as a writer feel hard to justify when thinking about, marketing the book or getting it on shelves. And, but they end up being the most interesting to me when I'm reading the book later. And I just didn't really find anything, not a goddamn thing in this book that like, seemed interested in exploring any of those spaces.
I think that the division between like the past timeline and what turns out, I guess, in some sense to be the present timeline or maybe the future timeline, that division ends up kind of creating like a worst of both worlds effect, right? Where like the timeline that leads her to that leads to her being an influencer, that is something that you would expect to have the effect of exploring the psychology of that person, right? But because it has to be cut down to make room for the other half of the book being this like mystery, it doesn't really have space to develop what it needs, right? Whereas the future timeline, ultimately, because it's only half the book and because she's just like not a very good character, you don't really see her in any sustained way, like truly making an effort to develop a plan to escape or truly making an effort to kind of, if it were a bit by, you know, there are a couple like clues, but then she doesn't really kind of like, it's not like she's doing like a running piece of detective work or like there's anything that, it's like the framework for something that should be plot suspenseful, but ultimately it's not really.
Yeah.
So it's like, From a marketing standpoint, you end up in the best of both worlds because you have both, hey, this is a think piece on influencers, and hey, this is compelling, you know, it's not compelling, but like you end up with something that can be spun both as, hey, this is going to be a page turner because there's this big mystery. Oh, and also we have this like consideration of the psychology of a tradwife influencer, right? Great marketing pitch. But then artistically, it ends up being the worst of both worlds because each of those approaches neuters the other and crams the other into too small a space to flourish.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that kind of take. I remember while listening, thinking that the... prairie life chapters were pretty underwhelming. Like, I did. I think there was a hint of some psychological complexity when old Caleb, you know, says, "Hey, it's time for us to do it," and he's finally hard, and she finally gets off. Which I thought was...
Yeah, that's a good point.
There was a hint there. Like, there was a hint at a deeper psychology, but, mm-hmm. like, it all got lost for whatever reason, you know? Just the small... There are successful things about this novel, like moments like those where there's something interesting happening. I also remember really liking her mother's thought that she should think of God as her audience, and then like this kind of radiates out into like her audience as a Tradwise influencer is her God. So I thought that was kind of thematically interesting, but these kind of little interesting things are few and far between, and you know, there's too many flaws surrounding them is kind of my take. I neither hated it nor loved it. You know, I wasn't invested enough to think much of anything about the twist ending. Like, oh, this is the future. Neat. Cool. Whatevs, right?
Okay. Well, that is a pretty good place to end. The state of high concept fiction in 2026 is it sucks.
Well, this one sucks.
No,
this one sucks. We don't know if they all suck, right?
No, I'm being facetious. I don't know if they all suck. I'm disappointed that this particular thing happened to get everybody's attention, but, you know, the next one maybe we'll do better.